Roundtable Osteuropa. Ein Podcast des Zentrums für Osteuropa und internationale Studien. Welcome to a new episode of our podcast Roundtable Eastern Europe. In the last episode, we have discussed the migration crisis at the EU-Belarus border. Today, we want to speak about a different aspect of migration politics, repatriation laws. In the recent past, Russia has been on the news for handing out Russian passports to citizens of other former Soviet countries. While this was often called passportization, this is in a broader context of something that we call repatriation politics. Today we want to unpack what is behind this term. For this, I have two choice experts with me today. Tatiana Zhozhenko has just recently joined Zeus from the Institutes for Human Sciences in Vienna, and she has worked extensively in politics of memory and national identity in post-Soviet borderlands. Welcome.
Hello.
And Tsipil Madayeva, who is a well-known researcher from Zeus. She's heading the research cluster Migration and Diversity here. Welcome, Tsipil.
Hello, Stephanie. Great to be here.
So let us start to have a look at the term in general. What is repatriation?
General repatriation is a term related to a process of forced or voluntary to another person, but it can be also an item, to the place of origin or their country of nationality. When we talk about repatriation policies, usually it is related to voluntary return migration and to diaspora policy-making processes backed up by repatriation laws. And repatriation laws give members of a diaspora the right to return, to immigrate to their so-called kin state, and they also serve to maintain ties between the nation state and immigrant or diasporic communities living abroad. So the repatriation laws usually provide a specific preferential treatment, I would say, and privileges for ethnic diasporic immigrants. So repatriation is a, you can say, the welcoming policy launched by nation states and that introduce legal framework for attracting and binding former citizens, but also co-agnates through a variety of programs. It could be in-gathering programs or specific diasporic policies. So it was the Second World War that the voices of repatriation and diasporic return became more prominent. And in the age of globalization and transnationalism, the list of nation states elaborating the right of ethnic return is growing. The most prominent examples are the Israeli law of return, Aliyah, and the mass repatriation of ethnic Germans from Eastern Europe, Russia and Kazakhstan to Germany, according to the Vertriebenen and Aussiedlergesetz, started in the 1950s and continued in the 1990s of the 19th century. So what began in Israel and Germany is today can be found in other nation states, in particular among post-socialist countries such as Hungary, Bulgaria, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Russia, and Armenia.
You know, I wanted to ask, what are the aims of those kind of policies? What do you think?
I was thinking behind the idea of repatriation is the notion of the nation as an ethnic, cultural, and linguistic community or a community of descent. And this notion goes beyond the concept of political nation defined by citizenship. Yeah?
Yeah.
So the idea that the state has obligations towards members of this community, even if they are foreign citizens, mm-hmm. yeah, and they are kind of ties and bonds with these citizens, which should be given the right of return. And of course, this right of return is rather abstract because for many members of this community, they never lived in these countries. Yeah, like the members, for example, people of Polish descent, which were repatriated after 1989, many of them never lived in the borders of Poland as a state. Yeah, They lived in the Russian Empire, they lived in the Soviet Union, they were, for example, resettled to Kazakhstan, but they never lived in Poland. Yeah.
So if we go back to the case of Germany, which you also mentioned, who were those German repatriation programs or policies targeting? Who were they aiming at?
This is a very good question. The repatriation law in Germany goes under the title Vertriebene Gesetz and Spätaussiedlergesetz. And according to this law, ethnic Germans living in Eastern Europe and also in the former Soviet Union had a right to return to their historical homeland. And this term, historical homeland, became quite prominent in the 90s in the former Soviet Union, based on the idea, what already Tatiana mentioned, the idea of ethnic nation state. Spätaussiedlergesetz, which was launched in 1991, aims to invite ethnic Germans who also have suffered during the Soviet time because of discrimination they experienced in their everyday life, because of deportation of Volga Germans before and during the Second World War. Those ethnic Germans who were living in the territory of Volga Germany and the Caucasus region, they have been deported to Siberia, to Kazakhstan. That's why we have the more than half of Russian Germans living now in Germany. Their homeland is Kazakhstan and eastern and Siberian part of Russian Federation.
Mm-hmm. So that's probably a well-known example for German listeners. What about if you look at Russia now? Maybe also looking back in time before we talk about the current situation and the recent changes in the law, how has Russia handled repatriation policies, politics? Tsipima, you want to start?
Yeah, I can start. But before we look at specifically at the Russian repatriation law, I would just mention two aspects of the meaning of the repatriation law from political and economic perspective. Because the main aim actually of this resettlement program is usually to counteract demographic decline and also to promote economic development of region, and that would say to maintain the ethnic composition of the population. So, and consequently, in official national discourses, it was also a case of Germany, that newcomers are usually represented as a reproductive force, as a national good, helping to combat the problems. So, as for the draft law on repatriation to the Russian Federation, which was submitted in June to the State Duma, we deal with a complex law, which is actually not new, because there were various state resettlement programs serving already to attract Russian speakers from the former Soviet states in previous years, in the 90s, in 2006. Among them, for instance, the state program of support voluntary return to Russia. And according to official statistics, the number of participants of this Russian resettlement programs is growing year by year.
So before we look at the current situation, I would like to go back in time a little. Now it's 30 years since the Soviet Union was dissolved, which means this was probably a turning point with a lot of new borders that had not been state borders before for many years. So if we look at Russia now, how has Russia handled the repatriation after the Soviet Union? How did it treat its compatriots?
Actually, in the 90s, immediately after the collapse of the Soviet Union, there were millions of ethnic Russians and Russian speakers returning to the Russian Federation or moving to the Russian Federation from the new independent states which emerged after the dissolution of the Soviet Union. But these people hardly got any state support. And this was, they were moving on their own initiative. The capacities of the state were too weak, and the government was preoccupied with other issues. And actually, radical Russian nationalists criticized the Yeltsin government at that time for not paying attention for Russian compatriots, and actually, especially those who were trying to escape from the ethnic conflicts and local wars on the territory of the Soviet Union. But later, in the next decade, I think the situation has changed slowly, and then these various attempts to introduce some kind of systemic policy towards compatriots. As Cepilma said, it was this state program for voluntary resettlement of compatriots living abroad to Russia. And it was from 2012, it has become like a permanent program. But it was actually, again, often criticized for the very kind of selected focus it had, because, as you said, Cepilma, it was actually aimed at counteracting the depopulation of certain regions of Russia, like the Far East and Siberia. And the focus was very much on like young people with certain professional training, which the Russian economy required. Yeah, and so maybe I'm now jumping too far ahead, I'm sorry, but I wanted to say that actually the new draft law was meant by the initiators and by the authors of this law as an attempt to widen the focus of this repatriation legislation. And Konstantin Zatulin, who initiated this draft law, explicitly said that we should move away from this kind of... The state program is more or less, it's just like a recruitment of labor force. But what we need is a institutionalized program which would help the Russian compatriots to return to the country.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, exactly. I completely agree what Tatiana said, that regarding these programs recruiting for labor force. And now, according to this initiator, it would be more about recruiting for the nation, the Russian nation. But the point is that according to the draft law, there isn't much discussion about who is actually a compatriot, who is eligible to apply for this program and to be returned to the homeland.
So, because I don't think we have introduced it yet, so there is a new draft law that is presented. Can you say something about the context?
Yeah, according to this draft law, a variety of Russian speakers, including Ukrainians and Belarusians, have right to the return to its historical homeland, and they can get Russian citizenship in a very simplified way. So it is somehow backed up by the Constitution of the Russian Federation, and it aims to provide support to compatriots who live abroad, and they should also be protected by the Russian state, which is delay, so in preventing their assimilation, and primarily in the states, and I quote, whose laws and practices create problems for the satisfaction of their national rights and interests of Russian compatriots. So comparing to previous programs of the Russian Federation, the new draft law is a change in the conceptualization of compatriots and the ways how this so-called return can take place.
So what is new about it, and what is the aim behind it, in your opinion, Cepilma?
Perhaps here it's interesting to see at three aspects. First of all, the idea how to define the historical territory of Russia.
Mm-hmm.
In comparison to the previous programs, it was clear that it mostly targeted citizens of the former Soviet republics. But according to the new law, it is somehow widened and also widened in historical perspective. The historical territory of Russia comprises regions in different historical periods, so including the Russian Empire, I would say. And it also, it is mentioned the Russian Republic, Russian Federation, USSR, and the present Russian Federation. So it is not limited to the borders of the Soviet Union. For instance, this is very interesting that they also mention specific ethnic groups like Polish people who might be also have a right to return to the Russian Federation. The second is how to define who are eligible to this program. And here is this very interesting topic to discuss, Tatiana. At least the draft proposes to create a list of peoples to have right for them, and explicitly they mention three ethnic groups like Russian, Ukrainians and Belarusians, because they are associated with a common historical destiny and culture, what we know in German language, Schicksalsgemeinschaft. And additionally, there are also a list of titular groups, those who make up the multi-ethnic Russian Federation. And then there are also numerically small indigenous groups, historical resident territory of the Russian Federation. I would also ask, where ends it, the Russian Federation, regarding indigenous people? So in this sense, it's a new degree of constructing the Russian reconstructing the Russian imperial homeland, and at the same time we observe a modern state nation building taking place.
Tatiana, maybe you can jump in here because you've been studying memory and national identity in post-Soviet borderlands. What concept of national identity are we looking at here, or how is it understood when you look at this law?
I think in already existing Russian legislation, there is some kind of tension between different conceptualizations of a compatriot. Who is a compatriot? Who has this right for privileged treatment? And and I think one concept which was actually in the Russian legislation from 2003, the law on Russian citizenship, when former citizens of the USSR were supposed to be granted Russian citizenship via a simplified procedure if they declare their intent to acquire Russian citizenship. So one concept was everybody who lived in the Soviet Union actually belongs to this imagined community of compatriots. Another concept is according to language. If you speak Russian at home and if in the family, and I think the law says in the family, everyday life and cultural sphere. But this new draft law actually makes an attempt to add also like a national dimension to the definition of compatriot and to define, as Cepelma said, national categories and ethnic groups, which comprises idea of being a compatriot, including Russians as a state-forming people, Ukrainians and Belarusians as connected to Russians by common culture and historical destiny, peoples living in the ethno-territorial administrative units, small indigenous people, and also other people historically living on the territory of the Russian Federation, which is, of course, a very wide category. According to some critical voices, this creates, of course, some ground for ethnic tensions and maybe even conflicts, because if you start to prioritize some ethnic groups over others, it cannot go well in a country, multinational country like Russia.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. This is a very important issue regarding the different understanding of nation and who is actually eligible to be a state-forming ethnic group in this multi-ethnic society. Just an example, the new for this draft law that they included not only Russian ethnic group as a state-forming nationality, but also Ukrainians and Belarusian people. And this is new regarding the Belarusian people because according to official statistics, going back also to the Soviet time, numerically, indeed, there was always Russian ethnic group as the majority group. And a second place took Ukrainians. And the third place actually was always mentioned as Tatar population. but now it's not the case, and this is an interesting development. Additionally, regarding the language, it's a very important thing, because 2020, Russian President Vladimir Putin, he introduced a new law that all Ukrainians and all Belarusians, they are considered to be automatically as Russian speakers. So it means that those who citizens of Ukraine and citizens of Belarus, there is no need to go through the, let's say, sort of examination of your Russian knowledge level. Anyway, according to the new draft law, there is no need to go through examination. It's enough to have some kind of knowledge of Russian language, and it can be proved just during the conversation between the applicant and the clerk.
This brings us to the concrete role that Russian repatriation politics played since the annexation of Crimea and the start of the war in Donbass. Tatiana, what role has those repatriation politics played, and what was the response, the Ukrainian response?
Just a short footnote to what Palma said about Belarusians. I think it's a kind of contradictory move to include Belarusians in this list, because Russia and Belarus there is a union state of Russia and Belarus, yeah?
Yes.
And actually there is a kind of, at least on paper, an integration process going between the Russian Federation and Belarus, and you cannot do both, yeah? You cannot somehow build a union state and at the same time repatriate Belarusians to Russia. From the Ukrainian perspective, of course, this draft law is not really something new. It should be seen as a continuity with previous legislative initiatives. And here one should probably start with history. In the last decades, economic and labor migration from Ukraine to Russia has been a significant phenomenon, yeah? But it was always a long way from an economic migrant to a Russian citizen for Ukrainians, and this way was long and complicated. And the war in Donbass produced more than 1 million migrants which moved to Russia in 2014-15, and Russia was struggling with, the Russian state was struggling with integrating these Ukrainian citizens. And in May 2019, Vladimir Putin issued a decree which simplified the procedure for granting citizenship to Ukrainian citizens from non-government-controlled areas of the Donetsk and Luhansk oblast. And 2 months later, Putin's second decree extended the simplified rules for granting citizenship to the inhabitants of the government-controlled territories of the Donetsk and Luhansk oblast. So actually the population of the Donetsk and Luhansk oblasts is now eligible for this simplified procedure, regardless if they live on controlled or uncontrolled territories. And according to this new procedure, Donbass residents are not requested to provide the proof of their Ukrainian citizenship being renounced. The next amendments also simplified the rules of granting citizenship to other categories of Russian citizens. For example, former residents of Crimea who had left the peninsula before March 2014, so which actually means if you lived in Crimea before, you have the right for Russian citizenship. And of course, behind this policy is not just the altruism of the Russian government. The issue of Donbass refugees has been used as part of the hybrid war against Ukraine. So Ukraine is accused of fueling this conflict and producing millions of refugees and causing this amount of human suffering. And just to come back what Tsipelma said before, also in this case, in In the Ukrainian context, we can see that there are two different and sometimes even conflicting logics behind this legislation. So on the one hand, there's some kind of geopolitical logic. According to this logic, passportization policy in Ukraine is supposed to give Russia a leverage in the ongoing conflict with Ukraine. So the more Russian pairs of Russian passports you have in Ukraine, the easier it is to put pressure on Ukraine and interfere in Ukrainian politics under the pretext of protecting Russian citizens. But the second logic is economic and pragmatic, and we know that Russia and especially some Russian regions suffer from the depopulation and from its social and economic consequences, and labor migration from Central Asia, while feeling certain deficit of non-qualified labor in big cities, often causes ethnic tensions and nurtures grassroots nationalist sentiments. And in this context, Ukrainians who are culturally close to Russians and are considered to be easily assimilated are regarded as welcome human resource for Russian economy. And especially also because the Western neighbors of Ukraine, Poland, Hungary, Czech Republic, Slovakia have become more welcoming for Ukrainian labor migrants in the last years and liberalized their legislation because they themselves suffer from the labor immigration to the West. Yeah, so we know that many Polish citizens are working in Germany or in the Great Britain. And to fill these jobs, they need more Ukrainian labor migrants. So there is a kind of growing competition, if you wish, between Russia on the one hand and European countries on the other for the Ukrainian labor resources.
Do you want to add something, Tsipina?
Just to add some more example regarding this mass distribution of the Russian passports outside of the Russian Federation, just going back a little bit, what you have mentioned known as a passportization tool, it's the same situation took place in Georgia in 2008 and before in the territories of Abkhazia and South Ossetia. So the Russia's military intervention in the Republic of South Ossetia was supposedly to protect Russian citizens. But however, most of the Russian citizens living in Ossetia were ethnically Ossetians, and many had obtained Russian citizenship only a few months earlier.
So since you mentioned the example of Ossetia or Georgia, how about other post-Soviet states? Is there anything specific about post-Soviet states deal with repatriation politics? And has this, now looking back at 30 post-Soviet years, what is the role of a Soviet concept of nationalities, or is it not important anymore?
I think it's important, very important, and repatriation laws have been launched by a number of post-Soviet republics, particularly in Kazakhstan and also in Armenia. Kazakhstan was one of the first post-Soviet republics engaged in the right to return for ethnic Kazakhs, most living in other Central Asian countries, but also in China, Turkey, and Mongolia. Introduced a special term for newcomers, for compatriots, which is in Kazakhstani language, is Oralman. And okay, the program was introduced, and 100,000 ethnic Kazakh people arrived to Kazakhstan indeed. But it was, let's say, not that successful as the government expected. Some of them, they remained in Kazakhstan and also as a labor force, and in particular as the tool to increase number of ethnic Kazakh people in the Republic of Kazakhstan. And from that perspective, from demographic perspective, I think it's quite successful, because if we compare the number of ethnic Kazakhs in the 90s, it was less than 40%. And if you look at the statistics in 2015, more than 60% of the population is ethnic Kazakhs. But it is not only because of the return of newcomers, mostly because of emigration of non-Kazakh people from Kazakhstan, in particular to Germany. I talk about Russian Germans. So there is a various success with these old programs. And if you look at Armenia, which is very much engaged for years to implement its repatriation law, also because of also to combat the heavy depopulation of the country, there are only a few people really use this opportunity to return.
Mm-hmm.
I forgot to mention that ethno-national, the ethnic components, does play an important role in the conceptualization of repatriation law in these countries. I mean, Kazakhstan, Armenia, or Kyrgyzstan, also Hungary. But if we look at the Russian version of this law, it's difficult. It's not necessarily the ethno-national component in the forefront of the concept. And this is interesting.
Yeah, I think Russia as a successor state of the USSR defines compatriots, first of all, as former Soviet citizens and their descendants. And even on the websites, semi-official websites, which explain the repatriation legislation and give like legal advice, you will often find formulations like, for those who feel nostalgic about the USSR. So this is how they define their target group is actually the former Soviet people. Yeah. So this is the main difference, I would say, because other post-Soviet states, they have this idea of a titular nation, which is, of course, the result of Soviet nationalities politics. And they build their repatriation policies around this idea of titular nation. But if I may, I wanted to add something on in this context of the 30 years of the dissolution of the Soviet Union and what role the Soviet the Soviet concept of nationalities had, but actually the Soviet policies of moving people around, yeah, and Soviet policies of forced displacement during Stalin era, when actually millions of people, due to collectivization politics, deculakization, expulsions, forced resettlement of ethnic groups, they became target of these policies. And for example, in case of Ukraine, not only millions of Ukrainians were, for example, deported to Siberia or put in the Gulag, but also Crimean Tatars, for example, were resettled forcefully, ethnic Poles, Bulgarians, Armenians. So when the Soviet Union collapsed, actually some kind of wild repatriation has started because millions of people wanted to return to what they saw as their homeland, their ethnic homeland or national homeland. And in case of Ukraine, for example, the return of Crimean Tatars to Crimea is a prominent example. So how people actually, they were waiting for decades for this opportunity to return to their homeland.
Yes, it's an important aspect to see what is actually associated with repatriation. But today, I think Russia's repatriation has more pragmatic meaning, and it has some features of like a foreign policy tool with far-reaching imperial ambitions in the past. Just to stress, the main factor of introducing a new law of repatriation is actually Russia's own national interest, and also interest in demographic improvement. But it is not based on a demand from Russian-speaking living abroad. So we have to do with repatriation as a geopolitical tool, and Tatiana has already emphasized this aspect. It remains open, and I'm quite skeptical about to what extent the new law will be a real pull factor for migration and mass repatriation movement towards the Russian Federation, because the situation is quite different and difficult in this country.
We have been talking about other post-Soviet countries and their repatriation policies. How does Ukraine deal with repatriation, and or how does it counter the Russian the Russian passportization, for example.
When the Soviet Union collapsed, there were millions of Ukrainians living outside of the borders of the Ukrainian Soviet Republic. And according to the Soviet census of 1989, 6.8 million Ukrainians lived in the USSR but outside of the Soviet Ukraine. And of them, 4.4 million in Russia and almost a million in Kazakhstan. Also in the West, according to some estimations, 2 million Ukrainians and persons of Ukrainian descent lives in the United States, and around 1 million in Canada, and around a million in Latin America. To this, we can add the new wave of labor migration after 1991, the so-called fourth wave, when a lot of Ukrainians went to Europe or to other countries to earn money. And of course, the Ukrainian state and the Ukrainian government So when the Soviet Union collapsed, as I said, a lot of people were emigrating to Ukraine, people of Ukrainian descent, and over 1 million immigrated to Ukraine in 1991-1992, so only in 2 years. And these were mainly, for example, Ukrainians who in the Soviet era moved to like big construction sites in Siberia, members of the Soviet military personnel in Russia or in Eastern Europe and their families. Yeah? And the Ukrainian law on citizenship actually guaranteed citizenship to the immigrants from Ukraine and their descendants, not just ethnic Ukrainians, but everybody with historical roots in Ukraine. So actually this concept was political rather than ethnic. But economic resources have been limited in Ukraine to launch a kind of ambitious repatriation program, and there have been recurrent public debates in Ukraine on how to attract Ukrainian labor migrants and diaspora Ukrainians to the country. And in 2004, after the Orange Revolution, the official status of a foreign Ukrainian was introduced, which included certain rather symbolic entitlements, for example, the right to study in Ukrainian universities. In general, under Viktor Yushchenko, Ukrainians living abroad for the first time came into the focus of the government and state policies, maybe due to the fact that his wife originates from an American-Ukrainian family. And for the first time in the Yushchenko era, actually, Ukrainian diaspora has become a topic of public discussions. Yeah. And the same after the Euromaidan, in a similar way, there was a campaign to lure Western educated young Ukrainians back to the country and recruit them for the public service sector. And again, this lasted for some years, but had only limited success. And I think what is also interesting that for the Ukrainian public discourse on this topic, the focus has been on the Western diaspora, so Ukrainians living in Europe, in Canada, in the US, labor migrants in Europe as bearers of non-Soviet mentality, of European values. So they are kind of seen as welcomed candidates for return. And Ukrainians living in Russia have traditionally been given less attention as they are kind of implicitly considered already assimilated to Russia. I think the fact that the Ukrainian legislation does not allow double citizenship makes the repatriation for the Ukrainian diaspora, especially in the West, not very attractive. And under President Zelensky, some kind of debate started that maybe this law should be changed and Ukraine should allow double citizenship, but not to everybody. So, for example, not for Russian citizens, but for citizens of the European countries.
Yes, this is very interesting. This is so comparable to the situation in Armenia, which also struggles with idea to attract the large diaspora living abroad, mostly Western diaspora who reside in US and Canada and France and whatever, and for the impoverished Armenian Republic, similar to Ukraine, it's for them it would be ideal to bring back their compatriots, but mostly to tap also their resources, to tap their knowledge, know-how, and in this way to renew their national republic.
So, thank you very much. As a bit of an outlook, maybe, in your opinion, what do you think on the subject of migration beyond repatriation politics? Will post-Soviet states open up to migration from other countries as well?
Yeah, Russia is quite famous as attractive place for labor migrants. Already started in the 90s and from different post-Soviet countries from Central Asia, but also from Ukraine and Belarus.
I wanted to say something I forgot to say, that Ukraine, of course, as a result of the war in Donbas, has to deal with internally displaced persons, around 2 million people who need to be resettled, reintegrated, given jobs, provided for. And this is, of course, this made the whole discussion on repatriation somehow secondary, because Ukraine first has to solve this urgent issue with the IDPs. Yeah, concerning your question on migration in a more general context, we know that this is currently the crisis on the Belarusian-Polish border, and the reaction from the Ukrainian side to some suggestions of German politicians saying that maybe Ukraine could take some of these people, actually a negative reaction and a kind of reaction of a populist sort. Yeah, I think it indicates that in the near future it's difficult to expect from Ukraine more open policy in terms of integrating like refugees from the conflict zone or from the global south. But also, I think these people also consider countries like Ukraine and Belarus as transit countries. They don't see it as an attractive place to move.
Thank you.
What we perhaps next, in near future, can expect is attempts to produce a new soft power from the side of Russia, and means that to improve its image. And for that, there is a specific institution, a state-sponsored institution, which is called Rossotrudnichestvo. It means Russian cooperation, under the leadership of Yevgeny Primakov, who is the grandson of former Prime Minister Primakov. And the idea of this institution is to promote a positive image of Russia through specific programs for those Russian speakers living abroad, but who do not necessarily want to move entirely to repatriate, but want to visit this country within, for instance, homeland trips, or for young people who want to study it at Russian universities. So they develop now new programs of free education at Russian universities. So that can be attractive for citizens of the former Soviet Union, in particular for Central Asian republics, or also Belarus and Ukraine.
Thank you. So thanks to both of you for your expertise, and thanks to the listeners for joining us. And see you next, or hear you next time on Roundtable Eastern Europe.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for this interesting discussion.